Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Spoken Heard. I'm Susan Dolby Chase, and today I am thrilled to bring you Daniel Lisi, who is a performer and a producer, and all this multi-platform art innovation comes from Daniel. So, good morning to you.
Good morning, Susan. Thanks for having me.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. So, what have you been up to lately?
Lately, we just finished an event. This Friday, we launched Tonya Ingram's Another Black Girl Miracle, which is a poetry publication that was produced over the summer. So we had an event for that on Friday. We're finishing a number of publications that are forthcoming between poetry and art throughout the fall. So we've been busy producing books over here.
Oh, wow. Sounds exciting. And I'd really like to get into that a little bit more with you about the publication side of the writing trade and how that all works, how you got into it and how it blossomed for you and what it is exactly that you do. What can we do to get publishing houses interested in us? But before we move into that, I just need to point out to my listeners that Daniel is involved in Game Over, which is a video game development studio, Not a Cult, which is a publishing house, and that's where the publishing ideas for the program have come from. The Float Museum, which is a virtual reality curation of digital art, and ArtShare LA, which is an arts nonprofit gallery in downtown Los Angeles. So he's got all of these irons and all of these artistic fires, and this is going to be a fascinating half hour. Daniel? I'm getting a message on my switchboard that Daniel has dropped. If he can call back, please. Daniel, if you're listening, please call 646-649-0897, and I've got him back. Hi, Daniel. Daniel? Hello, Daniel? Oh, he's dropped again. Well, I'm going to sit here for just a second and see if he can call back in again. Here he is.
I think I'm back. I'm so sorry about that.
I think you're back. Yes, you are. Yes, you are. I saw that you tried one other time, and now you're back. Fantastic. So I was just telling the listeners that about Game Over and Not a Cult and the Float Museum and ArtShare LA and how many different artistic irons you have and so many fires in the Los Angeles area. I just got done telling them what a fascinating show that I think this will be. And I guess I'd like to first tap into that publisher part of you. I know you've had your own work published and that you are a publisher. And so you've seen that from both sides. And I think that that's fairly interesting. What did you learn as a publisher who had his own work published to start?
Yeah, well, I guess that the lessons that I took directly from having gone through the publishing process is to have a very good understanding as to why you are publishing, what is the goal of the manuscript that you're putting out into the world, and the intention behind this voice that you as an author are trying to establish when working with a publishing house. So having gone through that process, it gave me an appreciation for just in general, intention-based projects. It really unifies a creative development team that's all working on the same project, because just because it's one a singular author working on a book, there's still generally 3 to 4 to 5 other people that are working on a publication to make it a beautiful consolidation on its own. And so mm-hmm. if there's a very clearly stated intention as to why this book is being made, and if that anchor exists for everyone to kind of attach to, it really creates an aesthetically unified project end to end.
Excellent. And so the 4 or 5 people who work on it have their own special duties, or do you kind of overlap one another and brainstorm together? How does that work?
Yeah, it really depends. So you have layout designers, you have the cover designer, you have editors, proofers. We have a distribution team that we work with that handles marketing and international distribution for our publications. So there are a lot of different hands that eventually have to manage some part of the mm-hmm. workflow of the book. And so if everyone mm-hmm. knows what the book is, deep on a deeper level than just reading it too, which hopefully when someone reads the book, they get it as well. But if everyone knows exactly what the author or artist is trying to accomplish, it really adds a deep level of strength to the project as a whole.
I would agree. I would see that's important. You need right out into the distribution, as you're saying, you know, when you're that whole retail idea to an artistic experience is very difficult, I think, for people at first to figure out how, you know, this is beautiful art and I love it, but how am I going to make money from it?
Yeah, great question.
What do you have to say about that?
Well, it's a really tricky balance, the monetization of art. It's something that is classically contested still to this day, and will continue to be contested moving forward as to the ethics to monetizing art. But ultimately, I think that there is a healthy balance that one can strike when creating work that is for a commercial purpose. And I think it's necessary to have both things. I think it's necessary to have art that is monetized, and I think it's necessary to have art that is not in any way exists to not be monetized in any sort of way. Mm-hmm, when it comes mm-hmm. to books, the goal is to create livelihoods for authors and artists that focus specifically mm-hmm. on their writing or their arts. And if the mm-hmm. goal is to create a system where you don't have to work at a coffee shop anymore, but instead you can just focus on writing all the time, then you definitely need to figure out how to sell your work, which is where a publishing studio definitely comes in handy mm-hmm. in creating a professional mm-hmm. Consolidation that you can sell.
Right, right. And so this is the kind of background that Not a Cult has grown out of?
Yeah, I used to work in publishing at a publishing house called Right Bloody Publishing, which is started
Fantastic
and run by
Chicago.
Derek C. Brown. He was in Long Beach, is where I met him, Long Beach, California, and mm-hmm. we worked together for a couple of years at Right Bloody, and so I definitely got a good understanding of the myriad of poets that are active in America's literary scene, and started to kind of assess how to build market models out of what already exists.
Nice. Bright Bloody seems like a wonderful place to start out. It seems like the whole, from what I've seen, because, you know, I'm not too far from Chicago, they just all have their hearts and souls into the industry, and they're so creative as individuals as well. And I'm sure that you run into that where you work too. I was looking through the list of the people who you work with, and I noticed that Bosia and some other people that I just absolutely have so much artistic respect for are on the list of people that you work with, and it's just fascinating. I bet that attending a meeting with all of you would be fantastic.
Yeah, I mean, it's I am very lucky that those are my work environments where
yes.
I definitely am in meetings with some deeply creative people that I respect, and it is I wouldn't trade my work schedule for anything else.
Yeah, it sounds like it's a wonderful. I couldn't believe it when I read your list. I was just like, holy cow, going to work would be just mind-blowing every day. So, yeah, that's amazing to me. So going back to the whole, editing and publishing of work, did you find it a grueling process when you were trying to edit and get your own work out versus being on the other side of the desk? Which one do you think is harder and why?
Oh, man, that's a good question. But I think that they're both equally challenging just for different reasons. When I was writing my publication, which is a very specific book, so I think that
okay.
I had an easier time publishing it, I think, because of how specific the subject matter is.
Mm-hmm.
So I was published on a video game press, a press that focuses specifically on literature regarding video games. So I wrote an entire book of essays about World of Warcraft. And so I didn't have too much difficulty in setting up the publishing arrangements because of how specific the publication was for the press. But finishing it and writing it was certainly a unique challenge that I didn't expect. I had seen it a lot where a lot of people will really wait until like the very last minute to submit a manuscript, and I didn't really understand that logic until I was on the receiving end of it, where I had my manuscript and was just like milking every last minute that I possibly could in having it and finishing it. It was definitely a daunting mental process. But once it was done, it was one of the most uplifting feelings that I had experienced, just to know that there was a thing that was finished and that I had completed something. And it was going to result in a finished project. That was a deeply satisfying feeling.
I would guess so. What's your tie to World of Warcraft? How did you get into that arena?
I just played a buttload of it when I was in high school. But also, uniquely, I grew up in Irvine, which is where Blizzard Entertainment's Southern California headquarters is.
Mm-hmm.
I think one of their original headquarters is stationed in Irvine. So I was obsessed with this game throughout my childhood, and I was also growing up around a lot of the developers that were making it.
Mm-hmm.
And I luckily had access to those developers as well. And so I was really immersed in the playing of it, in this fandom, but also immersed in the actual like creation side of it as well. And
mm-hmm.
so I had a, yeah, I was just really enveloped in it. So I wrote a book about it.
And is that where you got to the idea of Game Over, the video development studio?
Yeah, somewhat. So I was working after Right Bloody Publishing. I worked for a literary nonprofit called Pen Center here in Los Angeles, and that is where I met my business advisor, Brian Hughes, who had just finished making the Los Angeles Review of Books, and he convinced me to quit my job and go out for seed funding to raise capital to start a game development studio. So
wow.
I did that, and
what a leap of faith.
Yeah, it was an intense time period for sure. It was about a year where I had no income, and it was very unknown as to whether or not anything would actually work. And things continued on from there.
Wow. So then how did you know that you were a success with Game Over? I mean, what happened that seemed to flip that switch from unknown into, wait, this is going to work?
Yeah, it's the tricky thing about that is that the metric for success constantly changes without you really noticing. It's kind of like growing taller. Like, you're making progress, you're making progress, you're making progress, but you don't really notice, like, how far you've gotten from the initial starting point. And so it's just like, the logic was, all right, I just need to get seed funding and I'm good. And then I got seed funding. Then I was like, all right, I just need to hire my team. Then I'm good. Then I hired my team. I was like, all right, now I just need to get like two contract projects and work on one IP project. And then I'm good. And then we did that. And so it's just like, it just continued on and on and on. And I guess the metric is by merit of us being able to continue doing this kind of stuff. That is the metric of success, I suppose, is that we've been able to continue the model. We've been able to expand other models. I've been able to start other structures. So I feel now at this point that I have the ability to start structures that can be hopefully generative, at the very least sustainable. And that was the impetus for starting Not a Cult as well, is that we had experience in starting studio structures. So we were able to properly assess how to spend money and build a business out of publishing.
That's fascinating. And going back to just Not a Cult for a minute, because I know that most of my listeners are writers, how do you, as a publisher, look at manuscripts that come in and decide which ones you want?
So so Not a Cult is a pretty new studio. We're about a year and a half old at this point.
Okay.
So we actually haven't had a submissions period yet. Our first submissions period is actually coming up in October. On October 1st, we'll have poetry submissions that are open to the public. And so we haven't actually taken in, like, manuscripts in that fashion yet. Everything that we have published so far has been somewhat targeted. We have known who we've wanted to work with from the offset, and everyone else has come sort of holistically that way, where just from doing shows and experiencing the literary sphere in Los Angeles, there was a bevy of talent that was just ready for books to be made. And so we just engaged with that community and started developing work from there.
And most of these poets that you've worked with or writers that you've worked with are from the spoken word arena or not?
Yeah, mostly. So most, I would say actually all of the poets that we've published are extremely talented orators and performers. In their own way. A lot of them have their roots in the slam scene, but I would say that it's kind of this nuevo slam style. Like, a lot of them have developed their own abilities that exceed slam, or the archetypes of slam, at least. And you see this exhibited very strongly in the writing style as well, because the biggest challenge when publishing, one of the biggest challenges, at least, when publishing poets that primarily gear their work toward performance settings is that that doesn't often translate perfectly into a written setting. So seeing how the work translates into a publication is a big example of how finessed the craft of these writers are and how they are able to gear their work for either a stage or a page setting.
Truly a gift. It's truly a gift to be able to do that. I mean, there's so much difference between the variability of the audience when you're live and you're speaking and the energy of the room carrying that, and then being a page poet where it's more quiet, you know? It's more between you, it's more intimate in a way because it's between you and the author. However, it's not in a way as intimate as being in an audience specifically listening to this poet in your presence. How do you deal with that, or what are the tricks to making a stage poet more of a page poet for you?
I think that it just comes from knowing that there is a transition that needs to happen from, like, mm-hmm. what the effect is on stage versus what the effect is when someone is reading it. I think that
yes.
is just, like, from a technical standpoint, is understood by the writer.
Yes.
And so usually with the editing process, a good trick with editing poetry is just like, how can you say what you said in the stanza with less words? And that's just kind of a good starting point, is really mm-hmm. condensing everything, and being able to consolidate what you're trying to say in as quick of a bullet as possible, rather than
yes.
Kind of extending beyond and over-explaining or overwriting certain sections or stanzas.
Right, right. Yeah. Because when you're doing spoken words, sometimes becomes storytelling of a sort. I see what you're saying.
Yeah, it totally can. And that's cool. But it can definitely not translate well when put into print.
Yes, yes. And before we get back into the publishing thing, I have to ask you about your virtual reality projects, because I find this really
yeah.
fascinating. How did you get cool. involved in that, and what's entailed? And just tell me about it. Holy cow. I've never had anybody in my presence who could tell me what it's like to develop virtual reality. So tell me.
Yeah. So it was a pretty easy transition from interactive media development, so video game development, into virtual reality. A lot of mm-hmm. the development workflow is very similar. A lot of the tools
okay.
are the same. So there's this game engine called Unity 3D, which is a very popular tool to develop games. And they were very quick to gear their development support into virtual reality, so you can make entire VR experiences inside of that tool set. About a year ago, year and a half ago, started doing a lot of commercial work in VR, so developing a lot of projects for larger IPs or brand names that already exist. And then
mm-hmm.
from there, started to develop more contemporary art pieces with digital artists that are active in LA's gallery scene. From there, I met Ben Vance and Kate Parsons, who started the Float Project. We since became partners and started an entire studio around Float to develop contemporary art virtual reality experiences, which we very consistently exhibit in contemporary art fairs around the United States.
How interesting. Was that difficult, or was it just a real smooth transition from the video gaming world?
I think that the transition was relatively smooth. It's certainly been an interesting challenge figuring out just how to really properly operate in an industry that is so new.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that everything is so fresh. And there's
yes.
no monetization, not a lot of monetization models for virtual reality. Not a lot of people own headsets. The hardware developers are still trying to figure out how to make things cheaper for people. And there aren't a lot of people making an abundance of content. So it's all still very so small and new. And
mm-hmm.
so just figuring
mm-hmm.
out how to navigate that terrain and predict that terrain is a part of the challenge and the fun of it.
Yeah, I imagine. But you've got all these hats you wear with Game Over, The Float, and Not a Cult, and Art Share. How do you arrange your schedule? I mean, with all of these things all at once, how does one person do it all?
Yeah, it's a good question. And I had to ask myself this at the beginning of all of it. And
mm-hmm.
I think really ultimately I'm responsible for a lot of the macro work. So the top level structuring, and then everything else is then delegated to teams of people, or it's all just kind of top level activation of teams that then go and do the actual developmental work. And so with Nauticult, it's like I am managing the schedules of the authors to produce books, which then goes into another development team, which has the editors and the proofreaders, and then they're doing the work. And so it's just managing teams of people, which balances my schedule throughout the day of just interfacing with a myriad of different teams and individual creatives, and making sure that their needs are met, that they're comfortable enough to work properly and healthily, and just making sure that those work environments continue to run smoothly. And if they're running smoothly, then it's a pretty easy day. If there's a problem, then we have to figure out how to solve the problem.
Right. How many people do you manage?
Oh, boy. I don't know the exact number. I think it's like somewhere over a dozen, I would say, at this point.
Wow. And you have your own place where everything that you work with, Game Over, Nauticult, et cetera, are they all located in the same place, or are you all over the place as far as a location is concerned?
They're all fairly consolidated. It's not in the same place. So Nauticult has its own studio in Superchief, L.A., which is where I'm currently at. And so Superchief is this delightful gallery space in downtown Los Angeles, and that is where Nauticult is based out of.
Nice. So tell me more about how Nauticult has grown and what you're hoping to get in the future. Where are you headed?
Yeah, so we had a really excellent first year with Nauticult. The big goal was just to present ourselves to the world as a publisher with a catalog that people can get behind. So we definitely had a roster that we needed to develop out. So now that has happened, it's putting us in an exciting position of expanding the types of publications we do. We have a lot more than art and poetry coming out now. We have different forms of literature and nonfiction, and even our first fiction novels are coming out as well. So we're expanding our model into different realms of print, and we're going to be exhibiting quite a lot throughout this this year leading into 2018. The goal is just to continue to make more and more books with the studio and to continue to expand out in that way.
That sounds very exciting, and I wish you all the best of luck with that.
Thank you.
Especially since you're wearing so many hats, it's got to feel so empowering when something that you had as your brainchild turns into something so much bigger than just you. I'm imagining that it's kind of a dream kind of state to know that you dreamed up your own job and you got there on your own, and I think that's amazing.
Thank you. I've certainly had tremendous help throughout the entire process of it, and I have so many partners and so many collaborators that make all of this possible. So I certainly agree. It is a surreal thing that I get to do what I get to do. But at the same time, I definitely have teams of people that really make it all possible.
Yes, I would imagine so. Well, this half hour went so incredibly fast for me, Daniel. I just want to say thank you so much for being a guest today. If there's something coming out that you want to promo at any time, give me a call and or hit me up somehow so that we can have you on again. It's fascinating work, and I'd love to talk to you again.
Absolutely, Susan. This has been a delight. Thank you so much for your time.
You're welcome. This is Spoken Heard. I'm Susan Dobie Chase. Please have an excellent week, and until then, be kind to one another.